Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, by the narrowest of margins, a single vote, Congress adjourned without a decision on extending the Bush tax cuts. So, the debate goes to the campaign trail. We've got a bad economy and a big deficit. What we do on taxes this time really matters. Middle-class tax cuts only, tax cuts for all, including the rich, no tax cuts, temporary tax cuts. It's all being spun. Today we try to cut through the politics. This hour, On Point, taxes and consequences. Former Reagan Budget Director David Stockman will join us this hour. He's called the GOP pledge to America on taxes a big lie, but is also critical of President Obama. We'll hear from him and more. You can join the conversation. Do you want tax cuts extended for the middle class, extended for all, for no one? What's right for the economy, for the deficit? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. He has a new book out, The Little Book of Economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. It's a great little read and relevant. Greg Ipp, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So here we are, last night in Congress, 209 to 210. They adjourned without doing anything on this. That means at this moment, as we talk today, Greg, all those tax cuts are still due to expire. Nancy Pelosi says we're going to act on this for the middle class. But the debate is big and right at the middle of the midterm election campaigning across the country. Paint the spectrum of positions here at this point, Greg.
Well, the irony here, Tom, is that there's very little that actually divides the Democrats and the Republicans on this tax cut issue. Essentially, the Democrats want to keep taxes low for 98% of households, and the Republicans want to keep them low for 100%. So it's those 2% that really divide the two sides. And the reason they couldn't get this thing done before they adjourned before the elections was that the Democrats were afraid of taking an unpopular vote to extend only the middle-class tax cuts and allow them to expire for the people, for the rich folks. They were worried that the Republicans would portray this as tax increases at a point when the economy could least withstand this. Now, to be sure, not every Democrat was worried about this. The leadership, and especially in the House of Representatives, led by the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, are very adamant that those tax cuts for the rich must expire. But there are enough conservative Democrats, in particular those in the so-called red state districts that are fighting tough re-election battles, that simply didn't want to take that vote ahead of an election.
The president was certainly ready to see it go through. Here he is, Greg, at a rally this week at the University of Wisconsin. This is on Tuesday. President Obama criticizing the Republican plan to extend tax cuts for the wealthy.
Their main idea is a $700 billion tax cut for the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Right? So 98% of Americans would never see a dime of the $700 billion.
Of course, Republicans say that $700 billion for the wealthy would go into job creation. Here's House Minority Leader John Boehner on the floor of Congress, the House, yesterday, trying to force a vote on extending the Bush tax cuts for everyone. The House adjourned without that happening.
The idea that we're going to leave here and not extend all of the current tax rates to end the uncertainty is an irresponsibility on the part of this Congress.
John Boehner, yesterday on the floor of the House. Greg, if we've got political dynamics here and economic arguments, I mean, what's stronger here? What are people putting out front? Are they making economic arguments for the positions, the two positions, or something else?
I would say it's probably primarily a political argument and less an economic argument. You could make an economic argument for maintaining all the tax cuts based on the fact that the economy is still relatively weak. Yes, the recession did end over a year ago, but the economy is only growing at around 2% a year. The unemployment rate is not coming down. And allowing any taxes to go up early next year would basically raise the risk that the economy weakens again, perhaps not falling into a double-dip recession, but you certainly can't, you know, exclude the possibility. The truth here is that I think both sides realize that a compromise is in sight, and it'll probably look like the following: permanent extension of the middle-class tax cuts, temporary extension of those for the wealthy. But the problem is that neither side can do it now, so they've essentially punted this to the lame duck session. which will take place after Congress reconvenes after the election, but before the new Congress is seated.
Permanent tax cuts for the middle class, that's got like an unassailable appeal on its face politically. But as you know, I mean, we recently heard testimony on Capitol Hill from the Congressional Budget Office Director Doug Elmendorf saying that any extension of tax cuts might boost the economy short term, but it comes with longer term problems.
The problem is that if those tax cuts are not accompanied by other changes in the government budget and are simply funded through borrowing, that borrowing crowds out other private investment in productive capital, in the sorts of equipment, the computers, the machinery, the buildings that are the source of long-term economic growth.
Permanent, says the CBO director effectively, and you've got problems. Democratic Senator Kent Conrad, chair of the Senate Budget Committee, spoke as the director testified. He summarized his views this way.
Extending tax cuts would have a mildly positive effect short term, but it would have a negative effect long term because they're deficit financed. Just as additional spending would help us short term, but be negative long term.
Who's being straight with the American public here, Greg?
Well, you know, I think that what the CBO director, Doug Elmendorf, said is exactly right. I think what Obama is not being forthright about is that it's not only that we as a country cannot afford that $700 billion cost over 10 years for the tax cuts for the 2% richest. We also can't afford the $3 trillion, which is the cost of extending the middle class tax cuts. I mean, essentially, the CBO numbers show that we're facing gigantic deficits over the next 10 years and an ever-rising debt, which is already its highest relative to GDP since the 1950s. We as a country have got to get used to the fact that if we want government as large as it is now, we're all going to have to pay higher taxes. And that's, you know, that's the reality that is not being shared in this election season by either party.
What about the Republican argument that you should not tax the top 2% who have done very well in recent decades because you're then going to kill job creation of small businesses?
You know, it is definitely the truth. It's definitely true, Tom, that taxes do affect incentives. And so at the margin, if you raise the income tax rate on the wealthiest people, they will at the margin have a slightly diminished incentive to work, to earn, to start a business. They might, you know, pay their accountants more to find ways to hide their income. But let's remember, I mean, we're only talking about taking tax rates back to where they were before 2001. And it's not like the 1990s were a terrible decade for job creation and entrepreneurship. On the contrary, it was actually quite a good decade. And even Bush's own Treasury Department calculated that the impact on economic growth of all the tax cuts over the very long run would be very slight.
I mean, I'm reading here an analysis by William Gale, and he's saying, the vast majority of small businesses would be unaffected. Less than 2% of tax returns reporting small business income are filed by taxpayers in the top two income brackets, Greg.
Yeah, that's true. Now, there's a lot of debate over whether we're counting the right small business people. For example, somebody who collects $10,000 in freelance consulting income might count as a small business. Is that the kind of person we're worried about? No. We're more really talking about the kind of person who starts like a restaurant chain or a dry cleaner or the next Google in their garage. And it may be that that particular group of people will be affected, especially if, for example, taxes on capital gains and dividends go up, which is also one of the things that would happen if these tax cuts were to expire. But again, I think that the point that the CBO was trying to make was that we can argue about whether tax cuts are more effective if they're for capital, if they're for the rich, if they're for the middle class. But if none of them are paid for in terms of finding equivalent reductions in spending, the result is essentially just deferred taxes because that money will have to be paid back. The counter argument to that is that normally you would expect all that borrowing to drive up interest rates. And when that happens, you make it harder for private businesses to borrow and to invest in new factories and businesses and so on. Right now, though, we seem to have the opposite problem. The world seems to be awash in savings. Companies don't seem to want to borrow. They don't seem to want to invest. Households who've been beaten up badly by this housing crash are trying to rebuild their savings. And as a result, if you look in the bond markets, you see that long-term interest rates are only around 2 or 3%. So an argument could be made that that crowding out is less of a threat now than the possibility that we raise taxes too soon and tip the economy back into some kind of Japanese-style long-term stagnation.
Republicans eager to point at that possibility. Here's Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky at those hearings last week questioning the Congressional Budget Office director about the historical effect of tax policy.
Have we ever been successful in raising taxes to help our economy in a recession?
Not that I'm aware of, Senator. Raising taxes in a recession will tend to slow economic growth, and that's, as we've explained in our reports, part of why we have such a slow growth rate projected for 2011 under current law.
Greg Ipp in Washington, what do you see coming? We're going to hear in just a minute from Ronald Reagan's old budget director, David Stockman. What do you see coming on the other side at this point of elections when Congress comes back, lame duck? You gave us a sense of it, but how do you see this unfolding?
Well, Tom, you know what? For quite a few months, I was sort of part of the Beltway mentality here that once the election was over, the Republicans and the Democrats, they would put down their guns and their swords. They would, you know, start to tone down the rhetoric, and they would say, look, we agree on most of this, let's get it done. But I have to tell you, I've gotten a little less confident in that prediction in the last month or two. In particular, the Republicans, sort of sensing that the House of Representatives is within their grasp, seem to have been emboldened to take a tougher stance. They're talking about, if they can't repeal health care, maybe they can defund it. So what we've seen, for example, is that Congress has not been able to pass any of the appropriations bills they need to fund the budget. Yesterday, before they adjourned, they did pass a bill that said they would keep funding the budget until, the week, 1 month after the elections. So what I see is the political rhetoric and the polarization getting more and more pronounced in this town.
Greg Ipp, stand by right there if you would. I'm afraid that's all the time we've got. The Little Book of Economics is Greg's latest. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about taxes and truth, the big debate over who pays what next and the consequences. Joining us right now from Greenwich, Connecticut, David Stockman. He was director of the Office of Management and Budget under President Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 1985. The country learned something about deficits in those days. It was about $1 trillion. In 1981, when Ronald Reagan left office, it was almost three times that. David Stockman learned a lot in those years, I guess. David Stockman, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad to join the conversation.
We heard you talking with NPR's Guy Raz over the weekend. You looked at the Republicans', pledge to America and what it says about taxes and called it a big lie. What's the lie?
Well, they're basically saying that we will have no tax increases ever at any time for anyone. And at the same time, they're exempting 90% of the budget from cuts on the spending side. That is impossible math. That is condemning us to continue to run $1 trillion-plus deficits year after year. And it puts the Republican Party, as I see it, in a race to the fiscal bottom with the Democrats to see who can bury our children and grandchildren under more debt. This has to stop. They need to be truthful. I would like to have low taxes, but unfortunately we have high spending. And if we're not going to cut the spending, which clearly the Republicans have spent 30 years talking about, but doing very little of, then we're going to have more revenue. And the place to start is to allow these Bush tax cuts to expire for everyone, the middle as well as the upper income taxpayer.
Let all expire. That's tough medicine. We'll look at it. Of course, the Republicans, David Stockman, say, if you don't let the tax cuts roll forward for those with money, the top 2%, you're not going to have job growth in this country, and we're in a mess.
Well, we are in a mess because for 40 years we have been borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. We've created an artificial prosperity based on a massive increase in our national debt, massive increase in private sector debt, household and businesses combined. And through endless easy money printing, absurdly low interest rates on the part of the Fed. So all of this has created a bubble which has now collapsed. We're going to take years to work out of this bubble. I think there'll be very little growth. Living standards may even decline, unfortunately. But we can't borrow our way out of a problem that was created by massive excess borrowing in the first place. And so the Republicans, despite what they say, are being just as Keynesian as Keynes. They're saying borrow a bunch more money and distribute it to taxpayers, when in fact we couldn't afford those Bush tax cuts when they were put in my judgment, way back a decade ago.
Of course, they may be saying that in effect, but it's not what they're explicitly saying. What they're explicitly saying is we will be budget cutters. We'll keep taxes low and we'll cut the budget so this works. You say
I totally disagree with that. It's pretty obvious. They're talking about non-defense discretionary spending. That's about $500 billion in a budget that's $3.8 trillion. So let's call it 15%. They're saying that maybe they will cut $100 billion or 20% of that $500 billion. But even if they did, and I'll tell you in a second why I seriously doubt that the Republicans would stand up and actually do that if they had the power, it would still amount to a $100 billion cut out of a $1.4 trillion deficit. So that's a 7% solution. How can you say a 7% solution is meaningful or credible or honest in any way? Now, beyond that, even in this tiny corner of the budget that they said they will consider cutting, let's look at the record during the 8 years of the Bush administration.
Okay.
In 2000, spending in those programs, and this is everything from the National Park Service to education grants, everything in between.
Yep.
But spending was $260 billion. 8 years later, in 2008, spending was $420 billion. It was up 60%. There wasn't one veto by the White House of any appropriations bill in those categories. And so, therefore, with a track record like that, I have very serious doubts whether they mean what they're now saying about cutting severely into this sector. When they had the chance, they totally whiffed.
But they're not
at the plate, and they swung and missed every time. Why should you believe them now? I think the Republicans have been essentially faking for the last three decades when it comes to spending cuts. We tried it in the early 1980s. Made a tiny little bit of progress. 10 years later, all of those cuts were reversed. Today, it's just, I would call it vestigial rhetoric. It's archaic words that have nothing to do with what the Republican members of Congress do day in and day out when they vote. They vote for the same spending as the Democrats.
You're saying they're offering a kind of mosquito bite cut in an alligator deficit. Are you a Republican anymore, David Stockton?
It's very, it's a good question. It's very hard to be when you see this kind of behavior. When you see the Republicans, who used to be the party of fiscal responsibility once before 1980, who tried to cut spending or control it whenever they could, but if it wasn't sufficient, were willing to replenish the revenues, on a controlled basis. That happened during Nixon. That happened during Ford. Eisenhower actually increased the revenues in order to balance the budget. Well, we've lost all that since 1980. We now have two free lunch parties. I think the Republicans are as fiscally irresponsible as the Democrats.
That puts you in the guilt zone, too, in the Reagan years. Are you looking to expiate your guilt here, David?
Well, I don't know that it's guilt or expiation. I think we went too far in tax cuts in 1981, the Reagan administration. I said so at the time. I got severely criticized for it. Got taken to the woodshed for it. But the fact is, over the next two or three years, we did restore some of the excess revenue loss that occurred from that orgy of tax cutting in 1981. We restored about 40% of the revenue loss that had occurred. Now, that doesn't justify the way the whole thing worked out. The deficits were still too high. We couldn't do what we said we were going to do, raise defense, cut spending, and cut taxes. It didn't work. The math wasn't there. And as time went on, I realized the administration wasn't going to really address the problem, so I left, which is what you should do if you're in the White House and you no longer can support the policy of the president.
Very tough now on the GOP, David Stockton, the former budget director for Ronald Reagan. Tough on President Obama, too, and we'll look at that. Let me get a call in here first. Pembroke Pines, Florida. Farhan, you're on the air with David Stockman.
Hello, David. I just wanted to say I think you were right on the money with that argument that you had. And just to get back to the comment that I called in the first place for. So as an independent, I support tax cuts only for the middle class, I think it's important to look at the Republican perspective of, you know, not wanting to increase taxes because, you know, historically speaking, Republicans have always seen, you know, the Democratic policy and the Democratic way of running the government as being, you know, fiscally irresponsible and that the government being too inefficient. And so that rather than flushing their money down the toilet, which would happen in their eyes if they were to pay the taxes, they'd rather invest it and, you know, make their money or whatever.
Farhan, we've got that. But David Stockman says he sees more rhetoric than reality here. On the other hand, you're saying keep the cuts for the middle class, and David Stockman, that's pretty much President Obama's position, and I've heard you say that won't work. Why?
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree. If we could cut spending, that would be ideal. But after 30 years of proving you won't do it in any meaningful degree, I mean, a spending cut of a few billion dollars in a budget that's $4 trillion just isn't meaningful. Once that predicate has been demonstrated over and over again, then you have to face the music, because I don't know why we think in this country we have an unlimited credit card and that we can issue a trillion and a half of bonds each year. Really, it's $100 billion a month, if you can imagine that, month in and month out, and hope the Chinese or hope, OPEC will buy the bonds, because if they don't, we're going to have a real crisis. I think that is a very irresponsible way to run the government. So if we're going to have to raise taxes, then unfortunately you can't expect just the top 2% to close the whole gap. I think their tax cut should expire, but I think it has to expire for everybody. That's $200 billion for those 250,000 and below, $200 billion a year in revenue, that we desperately need if we're going to begin to close the gap.
Now, so you're saying President Obama's not being straight or completely straightforward here either with his permanent tax cuts for the middle class?
Yes, I think he's almost bordering on being as irresponsible as the Republicans, because clearly he's not proposing to cut any of the big entitlements like Social Security or Medicare. He was allegedly the critic of foreign policy, but it's now his war, his two wars, his $800 billion defense budget, so he's not cutting that. He's clearly not cutting the safety net, given the degree of distress and high unemployment and so forth affecting the country. So if that's the case, he's not going to cut any spending. We have $1.5 trillion deficit annually, and he's only going to raise taxes for the top 2%. That doesn't even begin to add up. In fact, raising taxes for the top 2% will generate $100 billion a year.
Period, you say. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa right here, if I may, David. Arlene, you're on the air with David Stockman.
Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I am a middle-class, willing taxpayer, particularly if the taxes are handled in a progressive manner so that I don't get hit more than the top 2%. And I will have to say that in light of that, what is concerning me right now is the cutting spending aspect of this argument, because I'm hearing more and more about cutting Social Security. We have to do something about Social Security. My take on that is that that was my money that went into that trust fund, not my tax money. And I would like to know what they think about cutting a program that didn't contribute to the deficit to begin with.
Right, so protect Social Security. Arlene, let me hold that right there, if I may, for David Stockton, and get one more. Wyndham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, fellas. Been a fan of yours a long time, David, and you are right on the money. I'm so psyched to hear somebody say that. Right on, man. You are so right on. I can see why the Tea Partiers are out of their mind. You know, it's a revolt of the haves, and they don't want to lose what they got. I can see why they're angry. But what would your plan do to get us out of this hole? I mean, would it be a split Congress like what Clinton had, or what? What's the? How do you get out of this?
What do we do, Stephen? Let us pick that up. David Stockton, Arlene says, okay, but you know, don't come after me, especially as middle class, and don't cut Social Security. And our caller Stephen in Connecticut says, you know, all right, he likes your critique, but what are you going to do?
Well, I think those are great questions, and it just indicates, I think, in some ways, how far the public has been misled by both parties. Social Security is not an insurance program per se. Most people get far more out of it over a lifetime than they paid in taxes, even adjusting, you know, for inflation and present value of money and so forth. So Social Security is a retirement program of the federal government that we can't afford for the upper income beneficiaries, and we're going to have to means test it. So people who retire that have other sources of income, substantial sources of income, are going to have their Social Security benefits cut. We're going to basically have a default on Social Security because we can't afford to pay all the promises that have been made over the next 2, 5, 10 years. Secondly, we've got to get out of the international imperialism business. It was a mistake to go into Iraq. We are lost in Afghanistan, accomplishing nothing. And we need to basically very quickly withdraw from these this kind of foreign policy and dramatically reduce our defense spending. We can't afford $800 billion, which is the defense and homeland security budget. We can't afford to be an imperial power.
David Stockton, let me get one more call for you, if I may. I know I've only got you for another couple of minutes. Omaha, Nebraska. Phil, you're on with David Stockman.
Hello, gentlemen. Talking about being honest with the people might not be, as you were saying, too popular a notion. Telling people that they're going to have to change, lower their lifestyle. What would a successful, truthful campaign actually look like?
That's a good question, Stockman. Phil, David Stockman, how do you put together a successful campaign on the kind of platform you're presenting here?
I think it would be tough, but I think the public would actually listen. Someone needs to say we've had a 40-year spree of living beyond our means, of borrowing more than we can afford to service and pay back, that we're now going to have to go through a period of correction, of austerity, of rehabilitation of our economy, of our balance sheets, and in the process, unfortunately, we're going to have to save more and spend less. We're going to have to get our government accounts in balance, and that will be less benefits to out of a lot of programs and more taxes to fund the huge gap that we now have.
What about just a couple more years of middle-class tax cuts to get the economy revved up again? Peter Orszag says, let's do that.
I don't think it'll rev up the economy. The economy is weak not because of a cyclical condition where we're going to rebound out of it. The economy is weak because we're at the end of a 40-year spree of excess borrowing and living beyond our means. So waiting for the economy to get stronger is a course of for failed action. And is a excuse for not facing up to our problems now.
Tea Party's up in arms, already pretty rowdy. You think Americans will take the medicine you're ready to dole out there?
It's really hard to say, but they have been lied to for so long, for decades now, that I wouldn't be surprised if there was a very angry, a very contentious, rancorous reaction. But sooner or later, the truth is going to come out. The facts can't be hidden. And we're going to have to deal with the issues. And unfortunately, when you paint yourself into a corner, it gets harder and harder to do something about it. And that's where we're drifting right now.
David Stockman, former budget director for President Ronald Reagan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about taxes and truth, the big debate over who pays what next, and the consequences. We just heard there from David Stockman, former budget director for Ronald Reagan. You heard his medicine. Here was Nancy Pelosi talking yesterday about, in her latest press briefing anyway, about what the Democrats want at this point.
There isn't a person in our caucus that isn't for tax cuts for the middle class. And it's not about the election. It's about the policy. And we're all very strong on that. And members with a vote or without a vote can go home and talk about their commitment to that.
It's not about the election, but it couldn't be done before the adjournment, which was last night, by a single vote. In Des Moines, Iowa, yesterday, the president continued to stump for middle-class tax cuts and continued to criticize Republican plans to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy.
You can't say you want to balance the budget, deal with our deficit, invest in our kids, and have a $700 billion tax cut that affects only 2% of the population.
And here's Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire at the Senate budget hearing saying the Bush tax cuts debate was misguided because spending is the bigger issue.
This whole tax debate, in my opinion, is really not what we should be focusing. We should be focusing on the growth of this government from 20% to 24%. And how do we get that back under control? How do we get that into a manageable number considering our revenue base?
Okay, but we heard David Stockman say the GOP pledge to America doesn't begin to get a handle on the spending that Judd Gregg is talking about there. We're joined right now from Washington by Jerry Seibes, assistant managing editor and executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, writes the paper's Capital Journal column. Jerry Seibes, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Berkeley, California, by Alan Auerbach, professor of economics and law, director of the Birch Center for Tax Policy and Public Finance at UC Berkeley. Alan Auerbach, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
David Stockman says we can't afford tax cuts for anybody if we really get real. I think you've said, well, let's have them for the middle class at least for a couple of years. How do you see what's going on, Professor?
Well, I disagree with his suggestion that the reason why we're in a recession now is because of 40 years of borrowing. I completely agree with him that we've been behaving irresponsibly from a fiscal perspective, but I don't think that's why we're in a recession, and I do think that we have to be careful adopting tax increases or large tax increases in the short term because of that. So I think we're in a very tough position because he's certainly right that we have to start making big fiscal adjustments soon. But I think in the short run, we have to be a little bit careful about that. And that's why I think a compromise of having middle-class tax cuts, but not permanently, maybe for a couple of years, followed by complete repeal of the Bush tax cuts and other measures as well would make sense.
Does that make you, you know, kind of a supply-side Republican here? Tax cuts and the economy will gin up and we'll be fine?
No, as David Stockman said, it's a Keynesian prescription, and even people who were doubtful about Keynesian policies came to rethink their views in the last couple of years. We've had the worst recession since the Depression. We probably would have had even worse a recession if we hadn't adopted stimulus measures. These have become unpopular, but I think they did work. Perhaps they could have worked better. And I don't think we should turn our back on them just yet. On the other hand, we do have to undertake fiscal adjustments, very large ones, very soon, and we haven't gotten serious about that yet. My preferred path would be to couple a modest extension of middle-class tax cuts for a couple of years with immediate commitments to make spending reductions in the future passed legislatively at the same time. That is not simply promises pie in the sky that we're going to do something about it.
Jerry Seib, you're there in Washington. I don't know how much of David Stockman you heard or have heard, but he's saying, you know, the pledge to America, the GOP's, is a big lie. It doesn't begin to balance things, that President Obama is not being straightforward with permanent middle-class tax cuts. He's talking about retrenchment, saying we've got to pay off 40 years of too much borrowing. I mean, in a way, some people may hear that as pretty rich coming from Ronald Reagan's budget director. On the other hand, you know, people are looking for clarity, and he speaks with a kind of clarity now.
That's true, although I think what's unfortunate in the conversation, in many conversations about this now, is I think short-term issues and long-term issues are getting kind of commingled and not to the benefit of the broader debate, which is to say, I'm not sure that the a short-term problem of a deficit that is at the core of the debate over the extension of the Bush tax cuts is the same thing as the long-term problem the country faces, which is much more structural, which has a lot to do with entitlements, and which is going to be there regardless of whether you fiddle around with some of the Bush tax cuts or none of the Bush tax cuts. And that's the issue that everybody needs to get onto. That may be, which is to say Medicare and Social Security are hugely expensive, are going to eat up more and more of the federal budget no matter what happens, unless something's done to curtail the costs. And there needs to be a realignment. Part of that realignment might well be, in a perfect world, a different kind of tax system entirely, or a rethink of the tax system to fit the new realities. But that's unfortunately not really what's on the table now. It's a pretty politically inspired debate about a fairly short-term question.
You say short-term, Jerry, but of course the president's pushing for permanent extension of these tax cuts for the middle class. That's not short-term.
No, but I mean the question of whether we will recreate a little bit more in the grand scheme of things, a little bit more revenue to deal with the short-term budget deficit is an important debate. I'm not disputing that. It's related to but not really discussed at the same time as a broader debate about how do you kind of make the long-term trend lines in the budget and revenue come together in a better way. And that's really what I'm afraid may be lost in this conversation. I do think that just in sheer political terms, the one thing that could probably get through Congress right now would be a 1 or 2 year extension of all the Bush tax cuts with a rethink then. The problem politically for Democrats is that pushes the ultimate decision about what you do with them into a Republican Congress, conceivably, or certainly a Congress in which there's much more Republican influence. So I think in this case, Democrats are kind of between a rock and a hard place.
I want to ask about those Democratic politics right now and how they're playing out. Jerry Seib, Alan Auerbach, please stand by. Let's get some callers. John in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a question. I'm kind of on opposite ends on the austerity measures in the middle class to a friend that's certainly in the upper class. And we debated back and forth on it, and it came down really to him making me realize even in the middle class, I'm responsible for the things that I did. And taking personal austerity measures against myself was the solution, and maybe the anger that he has at seeing it's only being put upon him and not the people had decisions to make for themselves.
What your rich friend is saying, the middle class brought this on with, over borrowing?
Well, I think what he's saying is that we're all responsible on all levels to mm-hmm. try to look at measures for ourselves because we all overextended ourselves. The problem with that is if I invest into lowering my debt, it goes into the upper class system, which in trickle-down economics isn't even happening, which is a fallacy anyway, invented by Stockman. But, you know, if I do pay down my debt, take my own personal austerity towards it, how is that money coming back to me? And it's to a point where the federal government almost has to force the hand to get these people to actually reinvest into the person who are creating the revenue.
Yeah, John, let us look at that. I mean, there's the who should pay what thing coming to the fore. Last week we saw MacArthur Genius Award for Emmanuel Saez. Alan Auerbach, I saw he and Thomas Piketty did this analysis, found that in the late 1970s, the richest 1% of American families took in about 9% of the nation's total income. By 2007, late in the Bush administration, the top 1% took in 23.5% of total income. So maybe the country should look there or not for revenue.
Well, the country is looking there. We're getting a larger and larger share of our revenue from high-income taxpayers simply because they have more of the income. That's, I think, a very unhealthy development. It's something that worries economists a lot, that because not really because of government policies, but because of changes in the nature of the economy, we've been moving toward a very unequal distribution of income after, you know, many decades of improvement or stability. This is a separate problem than the one we've been discussing, but unfortunately, it is a real problem.
But let me ask you, if it's separate, I mean, back in the 50s, 60s, we had a much higher tax rate on the wealthy, and the economy did pretty great. What about now? Could we do that again?
Well, that's a little misleading. We had a much higher tax rate on the very, very, very wealthy. If you look back at what tax rates were, they got up above 90%, but very, very few people were actually subject to those tax rates. But you're right. Having low taxes alone is not the only key to a healthy economy. And we certainly shouldn't look to that, and that's not going to solve the problems we have, for example, with respect to our income distribution. It's undoubtedly part of the problem that people feel very unhappy about their own economic situations that makes it very difficult for the government to frankly discuss what's going to have to be done in the future. You know, going to people and saying you're not going to get even what we've told you you're going to get in a situation where they're not doing very well is not politically not very, very possible.
Let's go to Mike in Lindenville, Vermont, if I may. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got a quick comment, just a personal situation. Got a 25-cent raise at work this year. Hasn't been a great year, but it was just saying, hey, good job. And by getting that raise, it disqualified my family for any assistance at all, like with child care. So I went from $90 a week paying child care to $300 a week just by a 25 cent, a $6 a week raise.
Ouch.
And I just wonder, like, with the rich getting all these tax breaks, you know, where's the I know that everybody can't say, okay, where's mine from the government? I just wonder if that's what the problem is that, you know, this revenue is just running out by everybody getting tax breaks.
Mike, we will pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Jerry Seib, multiply Mike by a whole lot of unemployed people or low-income people right now, and you've got a big political force.
Well, you do, actually. That's true. And, you know, it's a force that has to be contended with now, obviously. It also is a force that figures into this tax debate because, you know, there is an unequal distribution of income in this country, as you said. That's been a problem for a while. There is also a kind of a sluggishness in the job growth machine of America.
To say the least.
Sorry?
To say the least, I guess.
Well, now, for sure, it's dead. But, I mean, even before this recession in the early 2000s, when the economy was on the top line, was in pretty good shape, jobs weren't being created at the same pace that people had expected. And that tells you that maybe there's something wrong with the machine that will still be wrong with the machine even when we're out of this recession. And, you know, the income tax distribution has gotten skewed as well. I mean, half the households in this country now don't pay any income taxes at all. So you put all those things together, and it's not a healthy kind of picture that lends itself to a reasonable debate about tax policy. And those are all things that I think ought to be considered when we get out of this current situation that we're in.
When and if, and can't come too soon. John in Cedar Falls, Iowa. You're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom. My question relates to taxes on dividends, capital gains, and the inheritance tax. I haven't heard it talked about really at all. I don't know what Obama's plan is related to those or what anybody else's plan is. And my concern is that unless they are maintained as they are, for the middle class in particular, it can affect quite a few people. I mean, there are, you know, people that depend on dividend income for part of their retirement and so on.
John, let us look at that angle, if you will. Our time's getting short here. Alan Auerbach, how about it? The Bush tax cuts, of course, lowered tax rates right across the board on income, dividends, capital gains, estate tax. What do you see coming? What's being pushed or proposed now on those?
I agree with the caller that we haven't seen much discussion of dividends, capital gains, and estate tax, which is curious given that these taxes are affected by the impending expiration as well. This year, there is no estate tax. By the 2001 legislation, it was phased out this year. Unless some new legislation affects it, we'll go back in 2011 to the estate tax that prevailed before 2001.
Big jump
the
up
estate
there.
The estate tax typically affects 1 to 2% of decedents. It's not a middle-class tax, but obviously for the people it affects, it is a big issue. Dividends and capital gains, of course, affect more taxpayers. I'm not sure where that stands right now. The president, in his budget, when he proposed extending middle-class tax cuts but not tax cuts for higher-income people, also proposed raising the top capital gains and dividend tax rate to 20% from the current tax top of 15%, which would still be lower than it was in the days before President Bush, but I don't know where that stands right now. We haven't seen any discussion of that.
Jerry Seib, it's all going to be decided, I guess, in a lame duck Congress now. What do you see coming? And give us a little sense of the politics of the Democrats here. They are not all on board with the president.
No, they're not. And first of all, on the capital gains tax, you know, there is a desire on the Obama administration's part to raise it, but not a lot, to take it from 15% to 20%, and so to leave a differential there, which ought to please investors at least a little bit. But yeah, what you have right now is a situation in which nothing's going to be decided about the tax rates before the election. There's going to be an attempt to resolve this and a necessity to resolve it one way or the other in a lame duck session after the election. But how that plays out is very hard to predict. As I said before, I think the only thing you can see a path for right now is a simple punt, which is an extension of the Bush tax cuts for everybody for a year or two. But the administration is going to try to, even after the election, push through what the president has called for, which is an extension for everybody except those above $250,000 household income.
But if it's a punt, as you say, then at least by expectations right now, this will end up being decided in a Republican-dominated Congress.
Well, then that's the problem. That's the strategic dilemma for Democrats. And it's the one reason that the president has a little bit of leverage after the election. There may be some Republicans who don't have to worry about sort of towing the party line anymore after the election. There may be some moderate to conservative Democrats who, for now, want to extend all the tax cuts, but after the election, either because they've won re-election or they've lost their jobs, might see some virtue in what the president's proposing, which is extend them for everybody except the top income level, because that will produce some more revenue to get at the deficit. So maybe if you take politics out of it, it gets easier. I'm not sure I am convinced of that yet, but that's the White House hope.
A lot on the line here in politics. I don't know how far they can go out of this. Jerry Seib with the Wall Street Journal in Washington. You're great as always. Thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
And Alan Auerbach at UC Berkeley in California. Terrific to have you with us today, Professor. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.